Welcome back to Radio EcoShock.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with our guest, author Daniel Reardon. His new book is The Blueprint, Averting Global Collapse. As we're talking, you know, it occurs to me that let's say we had a World War II style effort where everybody's devoted to saving ourselves with a plan such as you suggest. We're going to build big solar concentrating systems and new water distribution systems. We're going to change a lot of things. The only way they did it in World War II was they had to ration out everything else. You only got so much sugar and so much butter and so much metal, and you couldn't buy a car because it took so many resources to make that change into war production. So I'm thinking if we come up with a big plan and make a move to save ourselves, we are going to have to give some things up. We just can't go on also building 10,000 square foot houses and buying SUVs.
Absolutely correct. I am not sure exactly what it would mean, but it will affect definitely our lifestyle. Right there with the whole discussion about footprint credit, it won't make I don't want to say financial sense, but credit sense to have like a 10,000 square foot home, because just the footprint overhead drawn from your account every month will make it completely nonsensical proposition. But bottom line, there is a need to cut back our lifestyle. There is no question about it, and we will all have to be prepared to change our mindset in this regard.
And I have an odd question to ask you. I have both listeners and a series of guests who say collapse is the best and only solution at this point. And they include the scientist Tim Garrett from the University of Utah, the UK environmentalist Paul Kingsnorth, and the environmental professor Guy McPherson, who we just had on. So what they say makes sense, but you and I will agree, I think that collapse is a horrible way to go. There's a lot of pain for people. So, Daniel Reardon, should we try to avert collapse if that's the only solution fast enough to cut the carbon or stop the environmental carnage?
Yes, you said this is the best solution. And immediately I thought to myself, the best solution for whom and for what? I don't see it being the best solution to anyone and to anything, even the environment. Let's think it through for a second. Do you really think that 7 billion people on this planet will go down without first cutting down the last of the rainforest, without shooting down the last of the deers? Long before people will die and succumb, we will basically decimate everything on this planet that can be used for food and for fuel. This is my idea of collapse. Furthermore, even if this was not a consideration, the legacy, the very memory, I think, will be part of, how shall we say, the cultural DNA of humans from this moment on. Let me phrase it this way. When the founding fathers brought about the story of the United States, this story stayed with us for decades and generations to come. The way we will handle the crisis, what we do and what we don't do, our apathy or action, our courage or cowardice, will basically shape the generations to come. And this is a horrible legacy. So both from an environmental point of view and for the sake of future generations, I think collapse, doing nothing, is the worst of them all.
So you've written a book on how to avert collapse. It's called The Blueprint. What will it take to motivate millions or billions of humans to adopt these solutions posed in your book?
The answer, what will it take to motivate the first few hundreds, is very different from what we take to motivate the first few hundred thousands. And once again, very different from what would it take to motivate hundreds of millions. But then again, you asked about the hundreds of millions part. What would it take is, I think, two things. A series of solutions that people can see a real way forward and out. Very concrete, very viable, from one side. And a second, basically, some sort of agencies, some sort of a government, with people who are up to the task. If they see there is somebody at the helm with the vision, with the courage, if they see our plans, I think those things will motivate people to really line up with this agenda.
And, you know, I hate to say it, but I think that's how Obama did so much damage, because he promised a great change and a lot of people believed, and then it didn't happen. But we won't get into that in this show. So, Daniel, when a person puts forward a paper in a university or in the scientific world, they have to be prepared to defend their thesis. Are you ready to be dismissed to handle all the doubt there is in this world?
Yes. After all, so not really about me. It's about technology, numbers, possibilities. And I'm simply taking myself as a personality equation and willing to debate, discuss, improve, change.
Tell us a little bit about yourself. How did you get started on this big project?
I actually was in the middle of writing another book, which I'll write this year. But basically, the idea was to put humanity on trial. It's basically a science fiction setting to explore some ideas. Then I was presenting both the defense for the human case and the other side. And when I was preparing the defense, well, I realized that maybe there is something that can be said. Maybe there is a way out. Maybe there is a way to redeem our ways. And this turned into a whole book by itself. So this is basically my case of defending the case for humans, our potential or possibility in future.
I'll be looking forward to the other part of the book. Well, you told me you hope to take this plan further, maybe into a group of people dedicated to making it happen. What are your thoughts on that?
Yeah, I had to ask myself a simple question at some stage. Do I really mean what I write? Or is it just a book? This is just an academic who's playing with intellectual ideas. If I really believe what we're facing, if I really believe there is a solution, am I going to do something about it? And out of this, I came with the idea of forming a grassroots movement, which I call Get Real, an action-oriented group, where I do want to implement the broad principles advocated in the book. I say broad because while I have a very specific scheme about energy, for example, it is subject to changes. All I'm really calling in terms of broad principle is lower impact technology. So having defined this, I do want to rally people around the idea of steering us away from the brink and changing the course of our industrial engine.
Well, as we finish up, if I just hand you this microphone, is there something else that you would like to tell us about?
I suppose I realize that all conversations come down to one assumption. Sooner or later, when we hear about grand schemes, we would say, yes, it maybe can work, but not with us, not with people. Somebody even wrote that we as a species are a scum. So therefore, none of those things can actually happen. And I just want to say that maybe that is not the case. Maybe that we can be a scum, but maybe this is a subject of the cultural framework, the container in which we operate. I want to suggest that we have been duped by the existing culture, while the defect is not lie with the human nature, but with our existing setup. And humans can be something else than what we see around us in the money-driven type economy.
Daniel Reardon is the author of The Blueprint, Averting Global Collapse. Daniel, how do people find out more about this?
Well, they can, for one, go to my website, www.danielreardon.com, and there's also a blog there. And, of course, they can find a book in Amazon, Barnes & Noble, and other places.
Check out Daniel's free videos, too, at danielreardon.com, and that last name is spelled R-I-R-D-A-N. As always, I'll toss some helpful links into my show blog at ecoshock.info. Daniel, I've run a ton of stories with experts telling us we're driving right off a cliff. You are one of the few people who dare to say we can still steer in another direction, and I thank you for that.
You're welcome.
I'm Alex Smith, reporting for Radio EcoShock. Earlier in this program, I lamented the shallow coverage of forest fires in the western United States and extreme rainfall events all over the world. It's as if scientists didn't write papers warning this would happen as the atmosphere is polluted with carbon dioxide. They did warn us, and most of the public still don't connect the dots thanks to a criminal collusion between news and weather reporters and their corporate advisors, advertisers, and owners. Take this case, raised by Joe Rome over at thinkprogress.org. The headline is, Kardashians get 40 times more news coverage than ocean acidification. The folks at Media Matters counted up the stories. It's a solid wall of reporting about these no-talent gossip babes, and a tiny sliver on page 92 telling the good folks at home, one minor detail, our carbon pollution has changed the chemistry of the vast oceans of the world. Oh yeah, and by the way, in teeny print, we'll lose the coral reefs, a bunch of seafood you love, and plankton at the base of the whole world food web. Did you hear about what Kim said after her latest divorce? What was the size of the settlement, and who is sleeping with her ex? Trying to save the reputation of at least one little pocket of the media, E! Magazine did a cover story on ocean acidification in June 2012. Take a look at it. We're going to talk to the author and editor of that green journal.
Radio EcoShock.
few humans know only the ocean saved us from devastating climate change already. At least a third of all the carbon dioxide we've tossed into the atmosphere has been gobbled up by the sea. Otherwise, we'd be baking in some prehistoric greenhouse world, perhaps. But there's a catch. Our emissions are making the ocean more acidic. It's one of the least known impacts of climate change. Britta Belli is editor of E! Magazine. She's written a cover article for the May-June 2012 issue titled Oceans on Acid. Britta, welcome to Radio EcoShock.
Thank you for having me.
As far as I know, there's no movement or even an environmental group dedicated just to fighting ocean acidification. What made you dig into this?
Well, I mean, as you said, it's off the radar of a lot of people, but among ocean groups, there's a lot of recognition of this problem. And, you know, it was something that we felt deserved greater recognition. So wanted to call attention to it. It's obviously one of many, you know, serious impacts that are affecting our oceans, but it's probably the one that's the least recognized.
We've got at least three major impacts to cover, but I was pleased that you picked up on the way the oceans have saved us so far. Can you talk to us about that?
Sure. You know, the oceans kind of act as a giant sponge for a lot of our emissions. They take up to, you know, a third of our carbon dioxide emissions, and that's helped, you know, over the years to really keep global warming from really being out of control. So they serve this very important function. And one that scientists have always thought is really a good function, something that's healthy for the planet. But it turns out that there is this side effect, which is the waters becoming more acidic. Essentially, they don't have enough of these certain minerals that are needed for creatures with shells, shellfish, and for coral reefs to form their exoskeletons. So the low availability of these minerals has meant that these shells are just dissolving or the coral reefs can't form rapidly enough, and that's leading to major die-offs. So this has become a very serious issue.
It's so hard to believe humans could even change the chemistry of these vast oceans here on Earth. Maybe we should start with a quick primer on what pH is and how we measure it.
You know, pH is really just the way that we measure acidity. It has to do with the activity of the hydrogen ion. The effect of these carbon dioxide emissions is that it makes less of these hydrogen ions available in the water. They combine in the water. It's a little like adding, you know, carbon to water to make soda, as one researcher described it. So you're changing kind of the basic chemistry of the oceans and removing some of these necessary ions from the ocean that these creatures need to form their shells. That's essentially how the process works.
But how do we know the oceans are becoming more acidic?
Well, they actually put monitors in the water, and they test the acidity. We've known about ocean acidification for a decade, but, you know, in recent years, oyster farmers and shellfish farmers out in the West Coast, Pacific Northwest, were finding that their oyster larvae were just dying off in mass quantities. They didn't know why. They were testing for, you know, presence of bacteria, and this is when they began doing this testing for the acidity, and they discovered that it had fallen pretty dramatically, and this ocean water they were bringing into their tanks, their controlled tanks, was actually corrosive. So the oysters could not form their shells and ended up dying. And it had a, you know, major impacts on the shellfish industry, but it began really to sound the alarm for people that this was having impacts today and that ocean monitoring needs to continue. So it's something that's now being tracked more often.
So there's a whole industry in Washington State. I found that kind of interesting in your article, that it's really a hub of shellfish industry, and yet it was tremendously impacted just by this, what seems to be a small change in the ocean.
Right, and what they found was that following a north wind, it would cause this upwelling event. So this deep ocean water, which is where the more acidic water is located, was being brought to the surface following a north wind, and that was when the oyster die-offs would happen. So it's a bit like a, you know, telling us what's to come if we allow this process to continue. These oysters were not being exposed to this water all the time. It was happening, following certain events, but this is the trajectory that we're on. And if we allow the acidity to continue at the pace that it's happening, all creatures with shells in the ocean would be at threat, and as would coral reefs.
And then there are those little plankton species called pteropods, and if you try asking anyone on the street what those are, you'll just get a blank stare. We can't even see them, I guess. So who cares if they have a hard time making their little shells?
Right. So, I mean, creatures like this, like the pteropods, is that they're, you know, what's important is these tiny little marine snails, these, you know, an important food source for other fish, like salmon and herring and tuna, as well as for whales. you know, of course, a lot, it's really this ocean food web on which everything is very interdependent. And you take away these tiny creatures at the bottom of this web, and it impacts so many other creatures. So the pteropods being at risk because they also require these minerals, as well as plankton, which we know, you know, so many fish and whales feed on. I mean, it could have a huge impact on the whole ocean food web.
This is Radio EcoShock. I'm Alex Smith with researcher, writer, and editor of e-magazine, Britta Belli. We are talking about your oceans on acid from all our fossil fuel pollution in the atmosphere. So let's get to that multi-billion dollar question, the impact of ocean acidification on coral reefs. Can you describe the several impacts that lead to coral bleaching or reef destruction?
Sure. Well, I mean, corals are built by these anemone-like creatures that form these crystals and stack them in these branches that we see. And without the minerals that they need in order to form these crystals and build these branches of the coral reefs, they begin to dissolve essentially. They can't sort of keep up the pace. The ocean water and other things that are feeding on it, in a sense, dissolve it before it has time to form. So it really is a very delicate balance for corals, and any kind of slight change can have a major impact. Corals are also very impacted by the temperature of the water. So whenever you have sudden rising of the temperature of the water, and you have the global warming is impacting coral reefs, you have pollution that's impacting them, overfishing, and runoff from farms as well. So there's a lot of stressors on coral reefs. Ocean acidification is just one of the most recent.
Right. I didn't know until I read your article that even a swimmer's fin touching the coral, they're sensitive little animals, and if you step on them, it hurts them.
Right. That's true. I mean, and especially these reefs that are these major tourist attractions, we have tons of divers. I mean, there's a responsible way to dive, a responsible way to be a tourist. Something we write about a lot in the magazine is ecotourism and how do you visit these pristine areas without harming anything. You know, I mean, obviously it's wonderful to go and experience this sort of diverse underwater world, but there's a careful way to do it without actually destroying the thing that you are there to see.
And what are scientists saying about the prospects for coral around the world?
It really doesn't look good. The coral reefs are really in great danger. We're looking at losing, if nothing were to change, in the next 30 to 40 years, we could have virtually no coral reefs left, according to the researchers that I spoke to. These various stressors combined with ocean acidification, it's just putting them in such a perilous position, and they're such delicate creatures. You know, and the other thing that I think is so sad, I mean, they're just so essential to the ocean, to our marine life, to our international economy. I mean, they serve such an invaluable place in our lives and in our world. It would be just a drastic loss if we were to lose the reefs.
Plus, they protect the erosion of the mainland in some places, and they form whole countries in some of these tiny Pacific countries. So pretty important all around. In that same issue of E-Magazine, there's an excellent article about the loss of mangrove swamps around the world. And you found that also related to climate change. Can you tell us about that?
Sure. The mangrove forests are very important. I mean, they also act as, they absorb these carbon dioxide emissions. So they're very important in also preventing global warming. They serve in a very important function for preventing erosion of the coastline in many Asian countries. They're really critical to keeping the things in balance. And they also actually, their roots act as a home for coral reefs. They're part of that underwater ecosystem as well. And in Thailand in particular, they have this shrimp aquaculture that's, you know, just this booming industry and is accelerating at such a pace. They're just essentially clear-cutting these mangrove forests in order to build these giant shrimp ponds and then, you know, filling them full of fertilizers and antibiotics. And essentially after 5 years, you know, they're no longer usable and they're just sort of left there, these polluted ponds, and they move on to a new spot and they cut down more mangroves. And, you know, it's really countries like the U.S. that are buying this shrimp and are, you know, really responsible for this kind of unsustainable industry. So it's really a call for people to be more aware of the seafood they're buying, where it's coming from, and what it's going to support.
Well, getting back to ocean acidification, we've talked about losing shellfish. People like to eat about the threat to tiny plankton at the bottom of the food chain and about dying corals. But I wonder, it feels like there's something even more insidious here. We're making the seas more corrosive, more acid. It's horrifying to think about. How did you end up feeling personally as you did this research?
You know, it's yet another example of just how quickly the pace of things is changing when it comes to environmental issues. I think that's what strikes me the most, is just the rapid acceleration of these changes. Everything's happening very quickly today, and these are really irreversible. So, you know, there's a lot of these other stressors that I mentioned, pollution and runoff, which can be brought under control if we, you know, actually enforce the regulations we have in place. You know, these are things that can be reversed. In ocean acidification, this is something essentially that can't be reversed. The same is true of the warming of the seas by global warming. This isn't something you can kind of quickly bring under control. So it really calls for immediate action and really global action to reduce emissions, to prevent these sort of this terrible, you know, future for the oceans from coming true.
And in a sidebar interview, you talked with Dr. Rob Jackson from Duke University. He seemed less than optimistic America would act on greenhouse emissions. Can you tell us a little about what he said?
Sure. I mean, his feeling really is that there's not the political will in this country to tackle these big environmental issues, and that without U.S. leadership on setting these aggressive emissions targets, that there's unlikely to be a real global movement or real effective change. And I think we are seeing that, you know, that this is just not, unfortunately, a major presidential topic. This, you know, in the upcoming election, it's not really getting the notice it deserves. And there's just so much focus on, you know, on the right, especially on, you know, polarizing these environmental issues and making this about regulation being anti-business, et cetera. So that's been, unfortunately, the focus. And I think that it's quite obvious what a terrible impact economically it would have for us to lose the reef, to drastically change the oceans and make it unsuitable for marine life. I mean, it would just have a devastating impact on so many economies around the world. So it really is an economic issue as well, and I think should probably be approached that way.
And you do cover some of the solutions, at least the sort of stopgap solutions of protecting reefs and enforcing laws that we do have. But I noticed that you didn't follow the usual journalism theme of ending with a feel-good solution or a happy ending. How did you get away with that? I mean, why don't you bring the reader to just feel comfortable with it all at the end?
Well, I mean, I think definitely some of these local strategies are important. I mean, you know, that needs to be emphasized too. So, I mean, in the terms of the shellfish farmers, they have steps they can take. The monitoring of the acidity is very important, that they can respond in time. These local solutions in terms of enforcing the laws and the protecting wetlands and mangroves are so critical to at least keeping things where they are and not allowing them to get worse. I think what's frustrating from the environmental standpoint, though, is this larger big picture issue is just not being tackled, and that's that of setting really aggressive emissions targets globally and sticking to them and really taking, you know, treating this with the seriousness it deserves. It's unfortunate we can't have a happier message there, but I hope it will serve as a wake-up call that it's important to keep pushing for these changes.
Can you tell us a bit about E-Magazine? How long has it been going, and how are you integrating what you do with the net?
Sure. E-Magazine has been around more than 20 years. It's a nonprofit environmental magazine. You know, it's really a consumer-friendly magazine. We have feature sections in the back devoted to house and home and eating right and health topics, green investing, eco-style, eco-tourism. So we really kind of, we cover a lot of things I think are very useful, kind of day-to-day stuff, as well as these big topics. Online, we're at emagazine.com, and there we have, in addition to, you know, our magazine content, some of which is opened each week for non-subscribers. We have regular blogs, we have videos, green apps, and regular weekly news items that we post on environmental topics. So there's a lot of things there. We have a Facebook page and Twitter feed, and people can find us many places.
Sounds like you've got it all going. Our guest has been Britta Belli. She's the editor over at E-Magazine and author of a cover story about our oceans on acid. Thank you so much for taking the time to tell us about this.
Thank you for having me.
So, listeners, ocean acidification, it's not yet a popular cause, but from what you've just heard, it should become a focal issue if we want anything like a living planet. That's my opinion. I'm Alex Smith for Radio EcoShock, urging you to learn more and to do more about the health of our oceans.
All played out. We must broadly unite to carry out the fight to resist the crimes of this system. But on the real revolution is the only solution. So we need to call out things whose time has run out, which keep people in chains, suffering unbearable pain. These things are all played out. Capitalist vultures, big time and worldwide exploiters, preaching about personal responsibility, ranting about predators and criminality, terrorizing the youth in the inner cities, while you loot everywhere you see. slaughter people and rain destruction through crimes untold. All to enforce your rule and amass your gold on the backs of billions, chaining them in slavery new and old. Your time in history, it's gone. It's all played out.
We are wrapping up this season of Radio EcoShock with this program. During the summer, I've picked out the most downloaded programs from the past year, the ones that broke through and still stand tall for our summer broadcasts. As I look back over the past year, there have been a lot of good things happening for Radio EcoShock. We added over 20 stations, including the prestigious WPFW in Washington, D.C., and Resonance FM in London, England. More and more net stations are picking up Radio EcoShock. We have two based in New York alone, including the rapidly growing Progressive Radio Network. I'm happy to be on that. I found other stations are picking up occasional shows or just some feature interviews. Thanks to KBOO in Portland for running a show recently. Come on, Oregon listeners, write KBOO and get Radio EcoShock on the air every week. Ditto to my Australian listeners, would you write 4ZZZ in Brisbane? They're on the edge of becoming our first station in Australia. Give them a push. Every station matters to me, large or small. You matter to me. That's why I do the show. Just this month, we launched the new Radio EcoShock website. It's still in its infancy, but Carl has given me some really powerful tools to develop the site more next fall. We still have gazillions of programs and other green audio for you to download as free MP3s. Please load up your computer, iPod, or MP3 player for the summer at ecoshock.org. And we finally have a search engine for the site. Thanks to another volunteer, Chris, we have a better blog at ecoshock.info. It's easier to read, and I can include photos of my guests and other goodies. Our podcast list grew by a third this year. That's a solid base of listeners and communicators who tend to pass on the program to others. Hello, folks. We're slowly developing our Facebook community, too, and this year Radio EcoShock began tweeting out every new show. It's a start. We added about a dozen videos to YouTube this year with the help of fans. I'd love to see every show up there, but I just can't do it all. My first love is making a great radio show for you, and that's what I pour my life into. The rest comes as it can. All in all, Radio EcoShock has grown in a bunch of different media this year, partly because the fringe issues I started covering in 2006 are now flying in everybody's face, central to all of our lives. It's just too big to deny. The question starting next September is, what are we going to do about it? Stay tuned for the best of Radio EcoShock this summer, some shows you missed, some scientists and activists that need to be heard again. I'm Alex Smith. Thank you so much for listening.